a week or so ago, she said that one of her teachers had said, well, what happens is you open your mouth and you die. So I'm hoping it's true. I want to say to the people who are new about Dhamma Talk, the purpose, in a sense, of this on the schedule and this in the evening or in the day, really is to help to deal with wise understanding, to get some sort of understanding about the practice, and also perhaps some inspiration for intention, wise intention. And I want to say from the outset that whatever rings true for you and is helpful to you, please take it. And whatever doesn't, just put it aside. And if anything I say feels like confusing or disturbs you in some way, please forgive me. That's really not my intention. So the intention is to talk a little bit in a different variation. I was thinking over the last 2 days, one day, how long have we been here? There have been all kinds of variations on the talk that I'm going to give tonight. And as we chanted this afternoon, that wonderful metta chant, I was thinking, wow, that's the talk. The talk actually is inspired by somewhat Martin Luther King, probably more deeply inspired by years of my interest in nonviolence in the Buddhist teachings. And what does that mean internally for practice for myself? What does it mean externally in the world? So when Tarania and I realized that, or talked about doing this on Martin Luther King Day weekend, we decided it would be a good idea to acknowledge a little bit, just a little bit, the importance of his work towards peace internally and externally. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to thread in some Martin Luther King quotes and ideas with Buddhist teaching. The title of the talk is, I'm going to be going forward and back. My eyes are on the verge of cataract surgery in one eye, so I see well with one eye and not the other eye, so sometimes glasses help. So the title of the talk is Hatred Never Ends Through Hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. That's a really famous line in the Buddhist teachings. So that's the title of, the subtitle is The Practice of Nonviolence. To say a few things about Martin Luther King, who was an inspiration for me to be here, actually, not in a heavy-handed way, but I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and all of that amazingly powerful work was going on in terms of nonviolent resistance. So just a few facts I got from, believe it or not, Wikipedia. He was born in Atlanta, Georgia, on January 15th in 1929. So he would be 78 years old on Monday, which isn't very old by today's standards. I know a lot of 78-year-olds and older, still quite involved in life. When he was 15, he went to Morehouse College. When he was 25, he had received a doctorate in religious studies from Brandeis. And when he was 35, he was the youngest person to receive the Nobel Prize for Peace. And it was given for his efforts as a peacemaker, promoting nonviolence and equal treatment for different races. He was assassinated by James Earl Ray on April 4th, 1968, at the age of 39. So 39 years he's been dead. He was there in support of a garbage workers' strike, which I had forgotten all about these details. And the strike had gone on from like February 12th, and he arrived in support, and there'd been a snowstorm, and they couldn't have the march, and then he came back. So at any rate, February 12th, he was killed on April 4th. The strike ended 12 days later on April 16th. Just this last little information that was interesting to me. He's one of only four individuals whose birthdays are recognized as national holidays by the USA. So Martin Luther King, George Washington, we've let go, I guess, of Abraham Lincoln. Christopher Columbus and Jesus of Nazareth. So those are the four. So here's the Buddha's, the fullness of the quote from the Dhammapada, the Buddha. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. As that strike did in Memphis, Tennessee. So, Martin Luther King, never succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter. Never. For if you succumb to that temptation of using violence in the struggle, unseen generations will become the recipients of a long and dark night of bitterness. Don't do it. So I listened to some of Dr. King's later sermons this week and was touched in many ways. In relation to Buddhist teachings, he understood, especially in the later teachings, that his understanding of suffering and his work towards the end of suffering was a process, not an end. In a sense, he understood the power of moving in the direction of the end of suffering. And in his last months, he understood that it was the strength and direction of intention in the human heart that mattered. He said, "We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force." And I was thinking, could we read that phrase, soul force, as wise intention, wise effort? He said, "You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive." So that's a question, right? One of the things that I, as I heard that, I remember Jack Kornfield, who is an important teacher of mine here at IMS, Jack Kornfield became a monk with Ajahn Chah in the Thai Forest Monastery in 1968. And he said when he arrived at the door and asked to enter, he was asked, "Are you prepared to suffer? Here we teach the suffering that leads to the end of suffering." I want to say that I know a lot of you are suffering, and you might not call it that, especially the newer people. It's like, what does she mean by suffering? But that mind that won't be still, the memories, the energy that's pulling us towards and away other people, away from other people, there's that suffering, and there's a sense in which that's right. You know, I hear people talking about your suffering today, and my heart wants to, in a sense, make it better, and yet it's right. This is what is true. There is a truth that suffering exists. And so I think of Jack Kornfield's words, you know, well, Ajahn Chah's words, "Here we teach the suffering that leads to the end of suffering." May that be true here, too. I also think of the Buddha's words to Angulimala, who was a murderer, redeemed murderer. And he said to him, the Buddha said, when Angulimala was being attacked, he said, "Bear it nobly," which doesn't mean, of course, simply grin and bear it. It refers to the Four Noble Truths. Understand what's happening. Make effort to abandon the cause of the suffering. Realize freedom and cultivate the path that leads to it. So nonviolence became the core of Martin Luther King's perspective and his teaching. This was clearly true for the Buddha. Both knew the truth of hatred leading to more hatred. They saw how mental habits of aversion, cruelty, and greed lead to more of the same. They also understood the value and legacy of nonviolent action. And if you can hear in both of those beginning quotes that hatred just leads to more hatred, don't succumb to bitterness, it leads to more bitterness. There's a profound understanding of karma there. What we do in this world matters. What we do in this world has an effect. So I want to speak tonight about nonviolence in our lives, in our practice, and in our hearts. So first, what about this truth? This is an ancient truth. What do we even mean by truth? I was thinking truth and the limits of perception. I've been studying and focusing a bit in the last months on a teaching around the aggregates and especially perception. So perception being, especially unwise perception, one of the ways we create suffering in our lives and others. And it might be our stance in relation to the wandering mind, the perception that the wandering mind shouldn't be happening. That's a misperception. So that suffering, and then we set up that adversarial relationship that actually leads to suffering, or that what we could call adventitious suffering, the suffering that gets layered on top of the pain that's already there. So anyway, I'd been teaching about perception, and so the Buddha says at one point that all perception, everything we perceive, what we think about, so perception being what the mind thinks about what happens. So something happens, we like it or we don't like it, and we think about it. And then that leads often immediately to action. But this thinking about things, the Buddha said, is always off the mark. It's always a little off the mark. So I just have to tell this story that I was teaching this a couple of weeks ago, and my mother's been visiting me. She's gone now, but she was here for 6 weeks. She's 89 years old. We have this great relationship, but there's still this energy, right? We all know it, of mother and child. Anyway, I was really busy. There was a lot of reading I hadn't done. I had to take her to some medical appointments, so I took her to one appointment, and I brought some reading, and one of the things I had saved to read was an editorial on not idling your car at the stoplight and at the bank, and how you can actually save gas that way. And it was a great editorial, right? And it had all of these interesting facts about if you don't idle at your bank and everybody else doesn't idle at the drive-in window, each bank could save something like 150 gallons of gasoline every year, and you could multiply that times the number of banks. So I'm reading this to my mother, and she's not anti-environment or pro-war, or, you know, she's pretty wise, actually. So I was reading it to her, and she said, I said, so what do you think of that? And she said, well, I have my opinion, too. And I said, Mom, these aren't opinions. These are facts. And, you know, totally forgetting everything I had said the night before. And she said, well, I have my facts, too. So in that moment, I woke up for a second. And I really appreciated that. But then I think about, okay, that and then ancient truth. What do we mean? Perception off the mark. Oh, so in thinking about what the Buddha meant by a truth, when he was talking about wise perception and unwise perception, the Buddha cut things in this way. Wise meant it was leading away from suffering, unwise leading towards suffering. Wholesome, leading away from suffering, unwholesome, lean towards suffering. Skillful, same thing, away from suffering, towards suffering, is the unskillful. So I think when we're looking at ancient truth, we're looking in the realm of wise perception here, wise understanding, meaning this is a truth that leads to the end of suffering when you get it. So that's true, so we can assume it had something to do with the end of suffering. I need my glasses again. In his awakening, so in the Buddha's awakening, he clearly saw the truth of suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path to the cultivation of its end. And he actually began to see that before his enlightenment. And one place he saw it was in the realm of perception, thinking. One of my favorite passages from the suttas is from the Majjhima Nikaya on two kinds of thought. And he says when he was still an unenlightened worldling, perhaps a bit like us, he began to see that some of his thoughts, some of his understanding, some of his perceptions led to suffering, and some of them led away from suffering. And the ones that he named as leading to suffering have to do with ill will, cruelty and ill will, cruelty and greed. So he abandoned. What he did was he abandoned them, and that's what we're taught in the Four Noble Truths, to abandon. It doesn't mean to run away from or to hate or to put under our zafu. It means to abandon the belief in, the energy in, to hold it in a different way, to change our relationship. And some of us were talking about this today. And as you're new to these teachings, it can be hard, this shift. It's a very big shift in understanding. And I want to say one other thing about truth for the Buddha was very important. And it has to do with the movement away from ignorance. So wise perception is a way of kind of waking up towards the way things are. Our practice is called vipassana, to see clearly. So we want to move away from lying. So if we're suffering, if we're feeling some kind of anxiety, it can be very skillful to name that, to know that, to not lie about it. So another thing about truth, I came across an article by Tanisara Bhikkhu on faith, which has been really interesting to me, faith in these teachings. And at any rate, in the article, he talks about two kinds of truth. One is passive, free of action, based on observation, empiricism. So we cultivate relaxation, as we've been doing. We cultivate alertness. We settle back, observe, and we see what's true. So the Buddha was transformed by seeing suffering, and we are too. This will actually transform us. And what another important verse in the teachings or phrase is "Ehi Pasiko," come see for yourself. So we're really asked to see this, to sit down, to see it. To come back to Martin Luther King for a minute, he was transformed by suffering. He was transformed in many different ways, and there was a point in which he changed, and some say it led to his assassination. He broadened his view to go beyond the national view, fighting for civil rights or nonviolent resistance, to take it to a broader scale against the war. And this is from an editorial that came out right after we went into Afghanistan in 2001. It was in our local paper, another one of those I could read to my mother, but I don't think I will. Anyway, here it is, the next time she comes. Okay, so this is the story of Martin Luther's transformation. He said, and it's in the words of Bernard Lee, a King aide who was with him at the time. So in an airport restaurant on his way to Jamaica for a rare vacation in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. picked up a magazine article on the children of Vietnam and the impact of American napalm. King froze as he looked at the pictures from Vietnam. He saw a picture of a Vietnamese mother holding her dead baby, a baby killed by our military. Then Martin just pushed the plate of food away from him. I looked up and said, "Doesn't it taste any good, Martin?" And he answered, "Nothing will ever taste good again for me until I do everything to end that war." From then until his death 16 months later, he was one of the most prominent opponents of the U.S. war in Vietnam. And it says his opposition stemmed primarily from his philosophical commitment to nonviolence. It's just as evil to kill Vietnamese as it is to kill Americans. Never could I advocate nonviolence in this country and not advocate nonviolence for the whole world. So here's this too. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this suffering, if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and laymen for the next generations. We'll be marching and attending rallies without end unless there's a significant and profound change in the American life and policy. And in his later sermons, he went further than that and was saying, unless where the change has to be is in the heart. He talked about the tensions in the human heart. And I want to say here, to be clear about something from the outset, although there are similarities between these men, there's many differences. And a major thing is that the Buddha was not a social activist. He had lots of opportunity to talk to warring kings, and you can read this in the suttas, and he never urged them to put down their arms. He was not an advocate of a particular system of governments. he saw something deeper about the nature of the human heart. So this is a quote from Paul Fleischman, who's done a lot of looking into nonviolence in Buddhism. So he said, the Buddha stepped out of convention when he insisted that the mind, not conduct, was the true target of transformation. For him, violence is an essential rule, a culmination of the meditative way of life. So King began to see this too. In fact, one of the later sermons, I think it's the one, the talk he gave the night before he died, he spoke passionately about the tension in the human heart as the base of suffering, and suffering's origin in the unchecked arising of the unwholesome habits and tendencies, winning out over kindness, ignorance, and self-centered craving. So about the Buddha, so the Buddha didn't proselytize, and he didn't try to convert kings, but he did encourage in his closest followers, in his monastic followers, a really radical kind of nonviolence. So here's this little summary. This is from the sutta via Andy Olensky. Something about, and this is for all of us really, but talking about tolerating abusive speech. So here's one way we could react with violence externally or internally. Just we could hate ourselves if we've been abused as well as hate the other. So here he says, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu, he understands thus. This painful feeling born of ear contact has arisen in me. You know? Unpleasant. And he understands that it's dependent, it's not independent. Meaning it doesn't have any essence, it's dependent. It's dependent on what? It's dependent on contact. He sees that contact is impermanent, that feeling is impermanent, that perception is impermanent, that formations are impermanent, that consciousness is impermanent. And then this advice, and his mind, having made an element, earth, air, fire, water, its objective support, enters into that new objective support and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. So what that means is instead of wallowing in the stories about he said that to me and shouldn't have said that, or what did I do wrong, that the pain is felt, the pain of the abusive speech is known, it's taken back to unpleasant, and then take the attention elsewhere. And that is often to, let's go to the body, what's happening in the body. So when he talks about elements, he's talking about that experience that we can have in the body. Now, here he goes a little bit farther. He says, now, if others attack that bhikkhu in ways that are unwished for, undesired, and disagreeable by contact with fists, clods, sticks, or knives, he understands thus. This body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. But this has been said by the Blessed One in his advice on the simile of the saw. So this is what the Buddha said to his disciples. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. So, and that's not saying one doesn't protect oneself or care for oneself as well. It's a tricky kind of thing, isn't it, to not hate? Somebody asked that question earlier. How do you have strength and discernment without violence? And I'm going to come back to that just to say, because I want to say a little bit more about action. So I've been talking from the point of view of that truth that we can witness, observe, that we can see the way things work. Remember Tanasera Bhikkhu, this article on faith and two kinds of truth. The second kind of truth brings us to this wise action. So Tanasera Bhikkhu proposes that there's another kind of truth other than just seeing things, and it's based on will, volition, and intention. This truth requires action and faith. It depends on what we do. So an example he gives is of a pianist. If, say, Horowitz, Vladimir Horowitz, It's true that he's a great pianist, but we don't know that, and he doesn't know that until he does it. So there's a certain commitment to the practice, we could say, but there's the doing of it. If we want to awaken and to have that important come see for yourself direct experience, if we want to be free, we must have enough faith to make effort to try out what the Buddha teaches. So it's almost as if that phrase that's so important, come see for yourself, is somewhat requires come do for yourself, and vice versa. There's this great simile from Thanissara Bhikkhu uses in the article from the Buddha. So here's the simile. A person searching for milk tries to get milk out of a cow by twisting its horn. Another person searching for milk tries to get milk out of the cow by pulling its udder. So that seems like an ancient truth, right? Pull the cow's udder and you're going to get milk. So what I wanted to do... Bhikkhu Bodhi, I mean, Thanissara has this nice thing that I just discarded. Here it is. So this is back to that cow's udder. He said the most important lesson and the most important item of faith is simply the fact of the awakening itself. The Buddha achieved it through his own efforts, and he did so not because he was more than human, but because he developed mental qualities we all have the potential to develop. To have faith in his awakening, thus, means having faith in your own potential for awakening. However, the specifics of what he learned in his awakening are important as well. It's not simply the case that he found what worked for him, while what works for you may be something entirely else. No matter how much you twist a cow's horn, it'll never produce milk. The Buddha's insight penetrated into how things work, what it means for them to work. These insights apply to everyone throughout time. So that's what's being said about this ancient truth. It's not just for the Buddha that hatred never ends by hatred. When summarizing his awakening in the most condensed form, the Buddha focused on a principle of causality that explains how we live in a world where patterns of causality fashion events, yet those events are not totally predetermined by the past. So that causality, that hatred causes hate. So nonviolent action, the other thing, during the Buddha's time, he was once accused by a general of being a total pacifist, that it was just a passive kind of teaching. And the Buddha said, no, that's not true, that he actually taught to turn away from doing evil, so to not do evil. But also he taught to do what is good and to purify the heart. So those three things sometimes can be, people say that summarizes what the Buddha taught. To turn away from all evil doing, do what is good, and purify the heart. So this is nonviolent action on the Buddhist path. In purifying the mind and the heart, we purify action, and action shapes the disposition, which shapes the intention in the heart, which shapes the action. So he did say, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering, so that division of skillful and non-skillful. And I was thinking of variations of that, violence and the end of violence, hatred and the end of hatred, cruelty and the end of cruelty. So to look a little bit just in a general way at the teachings as... You know, this is an overview of Buddhist teachings on nonviolence. But to take the precepts, which we did last night, they're all around non-harming. To take care, to be careful, to be kind and vigilant, to not harm. The Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. It was interesting. I read some Buddhist journal that there was an objection to that, and that the press and the media had taken it from the Buddha and simplified it and made it seem like a silly thing. And I was sort of into that. And I was talking with some friends we have a local inter-sangha group that includes Zen and Tibetan practitioners. So I was sort of, saying, well, I know that it isn't that simple. And they all looked at me like I was crazy, right? What else is there, Doreen? That's what it is. Kindness. So I thought I was joining them, and I was really felt kind of foolish. So kindness is what it's about. That's what the precepts are about. Mindfulness and compassion. I want to say about mindfulness as the just a great nonviolent teaching and a great nonviolent practice. Increasingly, in my own experience, I begin to realize that mindfulness and compassion are not different, that our ability to be present, increasingly to be present with our own suffering and that of others, is compassion. You're right there. Compassion isn't making things better. Compassion is the ability it means to feel with, to feel, experience the quivering in your own heart with the pain of another, or even to experience quivering in your own heart when there's your own pain. So not turning away from the grief, not turning away from the confusion. But yes, that's here. That's what it is. So mindfulness and compassion, the Four Noble Truths are about wise action. The Eightfold Path part of the Four Noble Truths, especially the action part, right? Wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. The Four Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic or sympathetic joy, equanimity. And this very wonderful teaching, not clinging to anything as me or mine, another important phrase from the teachings, not clinging to anything as me or mine. Martin Luther King, again, in that last talk, talked about what he called radical selflessness. And he gave this beautiful talk on the Good Samaritan. I know we all kind of know the Good Samaritan, but Martin Luther King talked about being on the road, actually being in Israel and the road to Jericho from Bethlehem. I think it's from Bethlehem. Is a very steep road, is a very rocky road even today. And all of these reasons to not help the Good Samaritan, and then he turned it to the people and encouraged them to help the garbage strikers. That there had been a lot of solidarity in Memphis, but people were getting tired. It had been 2 months, and they had their own work to do. And he was imploring them to consider their brothers. I mean, the strike was quite a racially based issue. Most of the garbage men were black, and so it was important. One other thing, this is like a parenthesis, in that last talk that he gave, and probably many of you have heard it, it's the I have been to the mountaintop speech. He goes on about how he's okay about dying, that I've seen it, that I know, that I understand that it's in the human heart, that I understand that we're not going to get there, or I'm not going to get there in this lifetime. It was very beautiful. So something to say here also about, I'm just going to put this in. This very wonderful person in our Sangha has two very ill children. One has childhood degenerative disease, so it's like autism, but she's actually watching him go from having speech to not having speech to not being able to walk very well. Her second, and he's now six, I think. Her younger child is four. Has been diagnosed with childhood depression. So she's just so wonderful. And she was talking the other day, and we were talking about this self-centered craving stuff. And she was talking about just going to bed and covering herself up with blankets and just realizing that that was just increasing the suffering, and how she could get up from that and realize that she had to, in some way, flow out from herself. And she's very involved now in trying to get schooling for the kids in the area who have similar kinds of issues, and how that is actually that movement of solidarity is so helpful to her, that movement away from the self-centered craving, the self-referencing all the time. So skillful means. There was a question today in one of the groups about a really important question, and I think it's a life question for all of us. How do you do it without anger? Well, how do you live clearly with wisdom, with wise discernment, and not with anger and hatred? How do you stand up for yourself? How do you stand up for others? And just a little story of recently, I was working with someone on a project, and we were really stalled, and nothing was happening. And I was confused, and I was really busy, and was just like emails back and forth. And then finally we had this phone conversation about why isn't it getting done, kind of both asking ourselves that question. And I found myself in that phone conversation getting really strong and clear in my presentation about what I could do and what I couldn't do and what my request for help really was. And it was so interesting to me because as it was happening, I felt this strength and I kept asking myself, is this anger? Am I angry? But it didn't feel like anger. It didn't feel like anger. It felt like clarity. There's a tarot card. I don't know if people know the tarot card system, but the Ace of Swords, and I was thinking of that. It's just a single sword. There's light around it. It's blue with this yellow light. And Vajra, courage, especially in the Tibetan teachings, has a lot to do with that clear, strong discernment. And it can fall over the edge, and it can become anger. But there's a certain energy there. And really, in these teachings, we're being asked to begin to make that kind of discernment, to figure it out. We were talking today about this too, that the teachings are about learning what suffering feels like and learning what non-suffering feels like, and keep learning that so that you get the taste of freedom, you get the smell of freedom, you know how it feels in your body, you can begin to trust the system. The system kind of self-corrects around freedom, this movement towards freedom. Tarania says, and I quote her all the time, we're hardwired to wake up. And it's true, but the system needs good, clear information. So, and somehow in the midst of that, we don't want to do that violently. You know, what is violence? What is nonviolence? We think we know, but it's an ongoing moment-by-moment investigation. We were saying this other day in a meeting that there is no, Jack Kornfield says, there is no enlightened retirement. It doesn't mean that those of us who are looking forward to retirement can't. It just means we have to stay vigilant. That this practice is about, the Buddha's final words were, the translation has been strive on diligently. Stephen Batchelor translates it as continue with care. Stay awake, really, moment by moment. So I'd like to end on time, and I'd like to say a little bit more. So how about if we just do it this way? There's some readings from the Dhammapada that I want to do, just a couple verses from the chapter on violence. I had wanted to read something from Martin Luther King, so I think I will do that, and then I'll read the Dhammapada. But how about if we just take a moment to settle back, so to feel again. To just feel again the contact with the ground. And to notice what's happening now. What is the body's response to hearing these words? What is the heart's response? Thoughts. Somewhere in the midst of it all, can you find the breath? So I think what I'll do, just to take this in this listening kind of way, so very much, one of the things I wanted to say at the beginning, that this Dhamma talk that's meant to help with understanding is actually coming to you in spite of yourself. What I mean is you don't have to think about it. It's not like being in a classroom and taking notes and you're going to be interviewed on it or tested on it. But just even more, can you just let go and this ear door, this hearing, just let it be bathed in these words. So just a little bit from Martin Luther King, and then I'm going to end with the Buddhist words. Here's Martin Luther King. I've seen too much hate to want to hate myself. I've seen hate on the faces of too many white sheriffs, too many white citizens counselors, and too many Klansmen of the South to want to hate myself. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear. Somehow we must be able to stand up before our most bitter opponents and say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws and abide by the unjust system, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with the good. So throw us in jail and we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour and drag us out on some wayside road and leave us half dead. We will still love you. Send your propaganda agents around the country and make it appear that we are not fit, but we'll still love you. Be assured that we'll wear you down by your capacity to suffer. It's interesting because in this practice, suffering, this kind of practice, wears away the edges of the self. But be assured we'll wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. So from the Dhammapada, the verses of the Buddha, chapter 10 is called Violence. The Pali is Danda, which means stick. He said, all tremble at violence, all fear death. Seeing others as being like yourself, do not kill or cause others to kill. All tremble at violence, life is dear for all. Seeing others as being like yourself, do not kill or cause others to kill. Don't speak harshly to anyone. What you say will be said back to you. Hostile speech is painful, and you will meet with retaliation, internally and externally. If, like a broken bell, you do not reverberate, then you have attained Nibbana, and no hostility is found in you. No naked or matted hair, no filth, dust, or dirt, no fasting or sleeping on bare ground, no austerities in a squatting posture. purify a mortal who has not overcome doubt. We all know the violence that doubt can perpetrate on us. Here's just two more. Here's one. Like a good horse alert to the whip, be ardent and alarmed. With faith, virtue, and effort, concentration and discernment, accomplished in knowledge and good conduct, mindful, you will leave this great suffering behind. Accomplished in knowledge and good conduct, mindful, you will leave this great suffering behind. And finally, irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, the well practiced tame themselves. This description of the Buddha from the Anguttara Nikaya will end with this. Tamed, he is supreme among those who tame. At peace, he is the sage among those who bring peace. Freed, he is the chief of those who set free. Delivered, he is the best of those who deliver. Nonviolence, says the Buddha, taught it was directed at each interaction in each moment. Our practice is the practice of nonviolence, moment by moment. So thank you all for listening, and walking period is next.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.